Good evening, everyone, and welcome to what is the launch event of the LSE's European Institute's Contesting Europe series of events. My name is Arnon Menon from King's College London, and I'm delighted to have four extremely good panellists who are going to talk about the upcoming European Parliament elections in the UK and whether people are going to be voting for, against or about the European Parliament. I won't waste our time by introducing people because I'm hoping you can read. And I'm going to try and keep the interventions short to about 7 or 8 minutes by each person so that we can have a lively and I hope sort of disagreeing debate afterwards. I think we decided to start with you, Simon.
Happy. I've got up here so you can all see me. Thanks, and thank you all for coming. I'm going to say a few things. Firstly, I'll say a bit about how we as political scientists try to think about and understand European elections and how they work as a vehicle to think about what's likely to happen in the elections in Britain in May. And what we know from studying past European elections is these elections are not really about Europe. In fact,
thank you. Thank you. 1979, the first elections for the European Parliament, were probably the most European elections we ever had. There was a sort of novelty factor, there was a reasonably high turnout, there was a debate about Europe. We just had the referendum in the UK a few years earlier. And it was interesting how, you know, there was a sort of excitement about this new European-wide contest. And then a group of political scientists, Karl-Heinz Reif and Hermann Schmidt, convened a meeting in Mannheim of scholars, political scientists who'd studied elections from every then member state to go to Mannheim and talk about these elections. And Hermann Schmidt tells the story of one by one standing up, and they asked the British political scientists at the time, and he said, well, of course, Britain's unique. We've just had a general election. Margaret Thatcher's just been elected, and so it was really a referendum on Margaret Thatcher, and it really was nothing to do with Europe, but that's just Britain. It's unique. And then the French guy stood up and said, well, we've got a big presidential election coming up, and it's all about, we're all very excited that the socialists might win this election for the first time in 81. And so really everybody was focused on that election. So it was nothing about Europe, just unique to France. And they sort of went around the room, and then they realized that every single, in every country of Europe, the elections were not really about Europe. The elections were about midterm national contests over who should win the next national general election. So they're about the performance of party leaders, about which party was currently in government, and it was an opportunity for voters to go out and protest against the parties in government and go and vote for extremist or radical parties or smaller parties just to thumb their nose at the mainstream establishment. And that has been the history of European elections all across Europe, not just in the UK. And you might say it's the same this time round in May this year. Everyone's talking about the fact that we're a year away from a general election, and the Conservative Party in government, the Liberal Democrats in government, are probably going to do badly. UKIP is going to do well. There may be some other protest votes. Greens historically have done well. On the other hand, you could say that, but actually it could be different this time. It could be different this time because Europe is far more salient than it's been at any time in any previous European election in the UK. Everyone's thinking about what is Britain's place in Europe after Cameron's speech last year. The rest of the EU is building deeper economic and monetary union. And there's a big question, what is Britain's role or relations to this deeper economic and monetary union that's being built? Should there be a new relationship between the UK and the rest of Europe? And this is a chance, in a sense, a referendum on Britain's place in Europe, a trial run of a referendum that we may have in Britain in 2017 or later. And this is certainly the argument that UKIP is making, and part of the reason why UKIP is up in the polls is because Europe is such a salient issue. Europe is also a highly salient issue because of the mass immigration into the UK that has happened as a result of free movement of people and the enlargement of the EU to 25 and then 27 EU member states. And in fact, the number of Poles to the UK in this period as a percentage of the British population is the largest immigration into Britain since the Huguenots as a proportion of British population. It's a huge phenomenon. So it's, depending on how you count the numbers, it's between 500,000 and 1 million from immigrants from new member states into the EU. What's amazing is nobody really noticed it until there was an economic downturn because the economy was booming. It was generating new jobs. immigration within the EU has now, for the first time, free movement of people has for the first time become a highly salient political issue, not just in the UK, but across Europe. The other elements that make this a really potentially a European election are, of course, the Eurozone crisis, less the case for the UK, but in other member states, the issue, the debate about Europe as a result of the Eurozone crisis should make these the first really genuine election about Europe. And there's a final element, which is a new element in the campaign, which is that we will, for the first time, see rival candidates for the Commission presidency. Martin Schulz is the candidate of the Socialists, Guy Verhofstadt, a candidate of the Liberals. We don't yet know who the candidate of the EPP is. We hear it could be Juncker, it could be Christine Lagarde, it could be Grybauskaite. We don't yet know. We've already got two Green candidates. Greens like to have two candidates, Scott Keller and José Bové. Will this change the campaign? You might at one level say nobody cares, the public won't know who these people are. But I think it will start to add a new element to the campaign which we've not had before, which is the media and the public will start to ask their national party leaders and their national politicians, which way will your MEPs vote when they get elected in May and they sit in the new European Parliament? Which of these candidates are you going to vote for Commission President? Papers, newspapers might actually write, what do these people stand for? What is their manifesto for Europe for the next 5 years? And so for the first time after these elections, we might actually see, publics might actually be able to recognise who the person is who eventually is elected Commission President, what they perhaps stand for, what their party family is that they come from. I'm not saying it will transform the elections, but it's opening the door to a new politicisation of the Commission, and that may change some elements of the campaign. But I have to come back to the situation that ultimately political scientists are probably sceptical and probably correct, that these ultimately will be elections about domestic politics. And the reason is the following. These are absolutely critical elections for all the major parties in Europe. And I know that my colleague Damien will say I'm stealing from Nigel Farage, who came to speak at the LSE and said exactly this when I was sitting on the panel next to him. He said, look, the Conservative Party has never come third in a national election in the UK, ever, since we've had universal suffrage. The Conservative Party is likely to come third. This could be a real watershed moment for the development of the Conservative Party in the UK, and this would be a disaster for Cameron. It looks like it's going to happen. If Labour doesn't win it, this would be a disaster for Ed Miliband. Labour has to win these elections. If they don't win these elections, they're the main opposition party in opposition. The opposition party has won every previous midterm European election because it's for swing against the government. If Labour doesn't win these elections, this is a disaster for Miliband. And the Lib Dems could actually be wiped out in the European Parliament. If they get 7 or 8% of the vote, which they're currently standing at in the polls for the European elections, they could lose all of their seats in the European Parliament. That would be a disaster for Nick Clegg and the leadership of the Lib Dems. So these are really critical elections for these three parties. All three parties will hope the elections aren't covered in the UK. They hope they go away. They hope there's incredibly low turnout, and then they can just say, well, who cares? It's such a low turnout, and you know, only crazies who care about Europe go and vote in these elections, and Europe's irrelevant, and these elections are irrelevant. That's what they'll try and say. But if there is a reasonably high turnout, turnout could well go up because we've got metropolitan borough elections at the same time, because UKIP are mobilising, and because of Europe is more salient. So turnout is probably going to be higher than it has done before. And then, if that's the case, it could be an absolute disaster for the three major party leaders. Thanks.
An American senator once said that where you stand in politics depends on where you sit. And how you see the European elections, I think, depends upon the vantage point from which you're looking at them. But I think from whichever point of view you're looking at the elections, these elections are likely to have a greater impact than any previous European Parliament elections, both in Europe and in Britain, for the reasons that Simon has given. Amongst those who run the European Union, they see these elections as strengthening the forces of integration, particularly because the Lisbon Treaty gives the European Parliament an important role in choosing the new president of the Commission. And that role will be even greater if the party groups themselves are able to choose the candidates for president of the Commission. They're trying to do that at the moment. They're nominating people at the head of their ticket. It's not yet clear whether the European Council will accept that or not. There may be a tussle between them. It's not clear whether national governments will still retain influence over choosing the president of the Commission. There may be a conflict. It's possible there could be a deadlock. But the implications are coming to be accepted that the president of the Commission, at least, will owe his or her position to the election. And possibly it will come to be accepted that other commissioners from other countries should reflect the results of the election. And that is bound to increase the legitimacy of the Commission in the European Union. And it makes sense in terms of logic as the Eurozone comes to take on an economic capacity, which it is gradually doing, partly as a result of the credit crunch. Because some of the main issues of domestic politics, the degree of austerity, whether we have a social market or a liberal economy, these matters are becoming the province of the European Union. So there is a real democratic deficit if the countries in the Eurozone can no longer discuss those issues as part of their domestic agenda. So there's a case in logic for these matters to be the responsibility of a commission which is responsible to Parliament. And the Maastricht Treaty of 1992, which laid out the timetable for monetary union, postponed or ignored the issue of democratic accountability. And that is now coming to the fore, that if the European Union develops an economic capacity, which is highly likely, in the Eurozone at least, then it will require legitimacy through a greater degree of democratic accountability. And Viviane Reding, the European Commissioner from Luxembourg, says that the Commission should be the government of the community in the future of the Union. The European Parliament, the lower house, and the Council should become just a consultative upper house. And that was the proposition put forward by Jacques Delors in 1990, when Margaret Thatcher famously said no, 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 and it led to her downfall. Well, of course, the movement of opinion has been different since then. But the dilemma for any member state of the European Union was first pointed out, I was going to say, by Hugh Gaitskill in 1962 when he opposed British membership, but earlier than that by Clement Attlee, who talked about the high authority of the Schuman plan for coal and steel and said this was unelected and unaccountable, the high authority of the predecessor of the Commission. So you may say make it accountable, but if you make it accountable, Westminster and other legislatures become subordinate parliaments to the European Parliament, and Hugh Gaitskill famously said that would be an end to 1,000 years of history. Of course, that's a particular problem for Britain with her long tradition of parliamentary sovereignty. Now, that's the view of the elite. Of course, the view at the grassroots is quite different for reasons that Simon has given, that these are second-order elections. And one of the features likely to occur in these elections, I think, is an increase in the strength of what one might call populists of both right and left. But one shouldn't overestimate the impact that they will make. Of course, UKIP is part of that grouping, because they are deeply divided. At the moment, they sit in four different party groups in the European Parliament, and one party, which you might put on the radical left, the radical right, the Hungarian party Fidesz, actually sits with the Christian Democrats, the European People's Party. And these parties are going to be divided also after the election. Nigel Farage has said UKIP won't sit with the Front National in France or Wilders party in Holland. And it's much more difficult, I think, for parties of the right to cohere than parties of the left. You can easily have a socialist international, but it's not so easy to have a nationalist international, almost by definition. But I think this time these elections won't be purely second-order elections, in that Europe will play a part, not only in the left-right sense, but in voting for or against Europe. Now, the people who favoured direct elections were, on the whole, integrationists. They hoped that the public would add to the pressure for integration in Europe. Instead, the many in the public are saying no further, or even let's go backwards, because after all, if the voters can say yes to integration, they can also say no to integration. Now, the paradox is that Britain is not alone in harbouring substantial anti-EU feeling, and that Britain is part of Europe in the sense that Europe as a whole is growing more Eurosceptic. And a Pew Global Attitudes report in May 2013 said that the EU is the new sick man of Europe. The effort over the past half century to create a more united Europe is now the principal casualty of the Euro crisis. The European project now stands in disrepute across much of Europe. And Pew surveyed 8 European Union member states, in which a favourable view of Europe was down from 60% in 2012 to 45% in 2013. And only in Germany did at least half the public favour giving more power to deal with the crisis, the Euro crisis. Britain, surprisingly, was not the lowest at 43%. France was lower at 41%. Greece, not surprisingly, at 33%. The Czech Republic at 38%. Support for economic integration was down from 34 to 28%. Britain, again, not the lowest. France, 25%. Italy, 22%. And Greece, 11%. France is most remarkable because until 1992, she was seen at the centre of the European debate. But the narrow acceptance of Maastricht prefigured her later rejection of the constitutional crisis. And the effects, broadly speaking, of the credit crunch, the financial crisis, as after 1929, have been to make countries more nationalistic. There are just 2 caveats that, surprisingly, support for the euro remains strong. Oddly enough, over 60% in Greece, Spain, Germany, Italy and France. Support's actually increased in Italy and Spain since 2012. And the second caveat is that Germany is moving apart from Europe in its strongly integrationist attitudes, and contrary to popular perceptions, it's amongst the most likely of the richer countries willing to provide financial assistance to other European member states with financial problems. Nevertheless, the division on Europe is leading to that most dangerous of chasms between the political class and the people, first shown in the French referendum on Maastricht in 1992, which divided the centre in France, which was for Maastricht, the Christian Democrats and the socialists, the extreme right and the extreme left were against, and their strength surprised many people. It's a revolt in part against the elite. It's perhaps worth quoting what was said in the British referendum in 1975 when Roy Jenkins was asked why it had gone so well, and he rather incautiously said that people took the advice of people they were used to following. Now, what happens when people are no longer prepared to follow or to take advice? Now, the view from London is that opinion polls, as I say, show similar feelings to the continent, but there's one difference, that Britain is the only one of the 28 countries where exit is on the agenda, put there by David Cameron in his Bloomberg speech last January, though, of course, David Cameron wants to stay in, but he's put it on the agenda, and polls showed that a large minority of the population, of the voters, and in some cases the majority, actually want to leave. And the argument, it's cut across politics in Britain since Harold Macmillan first applied to join, and very unlikely bedfellows. Those for Europe have been Macmillan, Jenkins, Tony Blair and Edward Heath, without much in common. Those against have been Attlee, Hugh Gaitskill, Enoch Powell, Margaret Thatcher and Michael Foote. Very unlikely bedfellows. But what the antis have in common is that they all say that Britain is a different kind of country to those on the continent. De Gaulle, incidentally, agreed with that view in his veto of Britain's first application in 1963. He said exactly that. There are all sorts of reasons for that difference, which perhaps I haven't time to go into now. But the key question, and on this I want to finish, the key question is this great chasm in the view from Brussels and the view from London. And since Macmillan, British politicians have tried to straddle that chasm, to reconcile the need to be in Europe where the decisions are made, to be part of it, to be present where the decisions are made, even if not wholly in our interest, and to fit in with the sceptical attitudes of the British public. And that threat, that chasm, grows as the Eurozone moves towards banking and fiscal union. The chasm becomes wider and wider, and as British public become more Eurosceptic. And the key question is, can that chasm still be bridged? And perhaps these elections will help to give us the answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much for the invitation. As an LSE alumni, I remember sitting in this hall on Monday mornings very early. It was mostly a quite pleasant experience, actually. But I was also taught one thing, and that was in international relations theory, you should never fall victim to presentism, which is thinking that now is the big moment. Now, this time, it will be different. And that's a big question. Are we now, when we talk about European elections, is this going to be different? Is this the moment when the public actually starts to vote and care about Europe as opposed to a lot of these side issues? And it's a very good question indeed. Maybe one or two of you have heard me saying this before, in which case I apologize. But Open Europe had an event a year and a half ago, where it was quite, the mood was quite tense. People were expressing their anger about Europe in quite stark terms. And I tried to calm the mood slightly. I said, but as Eurosceptics, you must appreciate that we should have a calm debate about this. And a man in the front row stood up, very angry, and said, "You have completely misunderstood everything I just said. I'm not a skeptic. I'm absolutely 100% certain." And I think that's where we're at in Britain. There are people who are, they're not skeptical. It's not that they're trying to weigh the evidence. They are certain that Europe in the European Union is not for them. So I do think, having told that perhaps one too many times, this will be about Europe to some extent. There will be people coming out in these elections not voting on other issues, but with votes outright against the European Union. So let's just be prepared for that. And of course, UKIP is channeling that frustration. But a lot of the points that I wanted to make have already been made, so I will keep it relatively brief. I will just give you 3 points why I think this European elections will potentially be about Europe more so than previous elections. The first one is, as we have talked about, the unique moment which the UK is looking at in its European, when it comes to its position in Europe, and this runs deep. Sometimes when I go around Europe, I hear this sort of proposition that if only David Cameron can disappear, or if only Nigel Farage can sort of be sent off to some former colony, if The Guardian can magically get monopoly over UK media, or even The Economist, even better, John, if all these things can happen, then Britain will turn into Belgium in a sort of a country of Europe-loving multilingual even people. It's not going to happen. This runs very deep, and I think what's happening now in some sense is that the combination of different factors and forces that have been around for a very long time. Let's just face it, Britain is not as unique as it thinks it is, but it certainly has a very different experience in Europe, and that sends back to World War II and probably further back. And the only way to turn Britain into a country of Belgians is to rewind to 1939, do World War all over again, and Britain loses. That's the only way to turn Britain into Europhiles. So let's just be honest about this. I think Britain is a very sort of specific country when it comes to sentiments on Europe. But there are a couple of other issues as well, which I think is very important. The Eurozone crisis has been mentioned. And I totally agree that the Eurozone crisis has now brought Europe into the domain of taxation and spending, where it wasn't before. Of course, primarily so in the Eurozone. And that makes Europe a matter of national politics. But in Britain, it has served as a vindication for a lot of people. It's not so much a Daily Express front page as the constant BBC sort of reporting from Spain, Ireland, and Greece that have hardened attitudes in Britain, I think. It is vindicating something that they always felt was the case, that the European Union was not for them. So it's that vindication. So that's the first reason why I think this will be about Europe, is that there's a combination of factors. But then the second reason, which I think is very important, is that on substance, there is genuine concern here. On substance, there are a lot of people in the UK who think that the EU has gone too far. Of course, the most conspicuous example is migration. We always hear this that voters actually don't care that much about Europe. If you have an opinion poll, it always ranks very low down, which of course is true if you ask Europe as a single issue, but it's not a single issue. It's multiple issues in one. It links, of course, to immigration very much so. Huge fan of free movement, like probably most of us in this room. But it comes with challenges, and it's fully rational to actually vote for, if you're against free movement or if you're against easy access to benefits, it's fully rational to vote for UKIP, provided that they actually show up and do the work, which is a big if. Sorry, Stuart, but it's true. Sometimes they can have a bit of better record in terms of attendance. This is going to be decided partly by the European Parliament. Access to benefits is regulated by the 2004 Freedom of Movement Directive, which the European Parliament has a veto over, effectively. So it's fully rational to vote for MEPs who are anti-free movement, if that's how you're inclined. So on substance, there is politics to play for here, which I think is the second. The third one is, as Simon mentioned, there's one party that has promised it in that referendum on Europe, and that's the Conservatives. And since the European elections will be linked to the general elections, certainly if you vote for the Conservatives, you will give them momentum. If you don't vote for them, you won't give them momentum. I don't know if that's how people will see it, but certainly that will be a main factor. So I think there are a couple of things coming together. Final point. This is not only about the UK, of course. As has been mentioned, there are issues on the continent with respect to trust in the European Union. Trust has fallen consistently, on average, across the European Union. We did an opinion poll in Germany recently, and we found that of 13 national and European institutions tested, the European Parliament was the second least trusted. It only was beaten by the European Commission. Who was the most trusted? That's the interesting question.
ECB.
Any other takers? Bundesverfassungsgericht, the dudes in the red robes, the constitutional court, who recently almost struck down the bond buying program, which probably will make them even more trusted. So it's quite interesting, right? I mean, there's stuff going on here which is going to have an impact. But what can this mean for the European Parliament itself? Well, no doubt, there will be a lot of votes casted for politicians who aren't particularly keen on the EU. But the risk, of course, is that whilst it's fully legitimate and part of democracy to do this, I actually think that the vast majority of Europeans want European cooperation but want the EU to do a lot less. I think that's the default baseline position. Certainly that's the case in the UK, certainly that's the case in Scandinavia, also the case in Germany, the Netherlands, and a lot of other places. Where is the voice going to be for them in the European Parliament? Are we creating an artificially polarised European Parliament that actually represent the majority opinion? And that's what we're about. And that, I think, will be unfortunate and something that we should take seriously. Thank you.
I think I'd agree with almost everything that Simon and Mads have said about the British debate and its implications relating to the European Parliament. But looking at the title for this debate, what I'm going to sort of argue in the next 5 minutes is that what matters is not, in relation to the United Kingdom and the European Parliament elections, what we in Britain vote for, but increasingly what those in the north of the euro area vote for. And whether they vote for Europe or not is probably going to have a bigger impact on UK European Parliament UK EU elections than anything else. And let me explain why. First of all, how important are these elections, and I'm talking now as a lawyer, institutionally.
Let's see what the European Parliament does. Firstly, it legislates. Now it is legislating, if one looks in practice, regardless of the formal arrangements, less than at any time in the last 15 years. That legislation, lawmaking has fallen off. In the EU, they're adopting about 20 directives, many of which are reviewing legislation. They're adopting about 70 legislation. This is down by about 60%. Even allowing for greater European Parliament influence, in terms of the laws that it passes that will affect us here in the UK, it will be less. Particularly when we bear in mind that much of the legislation it now doesn't affect the UK because it's about immigration and some aspects of policing and judicial cooperation. Secondly, it appoints the Commission. And we've heard about this Commission President and we've heard all this posturing by the political groupings. I think they do a lot of this posturing because they now have so much time on their hands. They've got nothing else to think about. I should remind them as a lawyer that it's actually the European Council that nominates the president, and we will which has to take account of European Parliament elections, but it may take a view that people are voting for less Europe rather than more Europe, and that European People's Party agenda is not one it will subscribe to. We will have to wait and see. There will clearly always be hostages in the nomination process. One or two commissioners will go past the way, but I don't think they will have a voice. But I don't think this is really what European citizens are lying awake about at night. So if you look at what the European Parliament does, in a sense, if you're a British citizen at that level directly, it's less important for us possibly than in previous European Parliament elections. However, why do these elections matter? And I'm going to say this as a lawyer. They matter because of what the German Constitutional Court did on the 14th of January and what was announced last Thursday. And I better just take you through it briefly. The German Constitutional Court, by the way, did pretty much outlaw bond buying. What it was the challenge in relation to from a mere 40,000 German citizens at the last count was the programme of outright monetary transactions. This is a system that's put up for possible unlimited bond purchases of euro states whose spreads have got too great. And this was challenged, this commitment, by the ECB, and two things were found prima facie illegal about it by the German Constitutional Court. They first of all said, and this was really significant, that the ECB had no power to engage in significant bond buying. This no one had expected. So it can't even buy and sell bonds with private banks. It's not just about sponsoring euro area states directly through buying their bonds. Secondly, they said, and they gave lots of examples of how you might get rid of it, and they said all of these would be illegal. They said there was a prohibition on bailing out states, the prohibition on monetary financing. All they said that would be possible would be for the ECB to provide some assistance to the European Stability Mechanism. Now, what does this mean for the euro area? It means there can be no lender of last resort. It means that the only game in town is now the European Stability Mechanism. This is the international treaty through which states lend each other money and which is now, from the German perspective, policed and monitored by national parliaments. Now, no system of fiscal transfers in the world that I'm aware of relies on it being done predominantly by national parliaments. The German model within Germany doesn't. It's run through constitutional principles, largely operated by the Constitutional Court. The other model in Australia, they use a commission to do it. So you're asking within the euro area for probably an increase of significant fiscal redistribution to be agreed by national parliaments have shown no inclination to do it. They have two choices, as far as I see it, greater fiscal union or the euro is in real trouble. Now, why these elections will matter is, of course, politicians will look at them at a signal, particularly in North Europe, whether their citizens will be ready to put up more cash or not. And the indications are no. Now, why does this matter for the UK? It matters for two reasons. The first, the markets begin to pick up on this. One could see things like the pound appreciating, the recovery tailing off. Well, I dare say that voters, UKIP, and some parts of the Conservative Party will make hay from this and will ask for pressure for the referendum to be brought forward will increase. And if things really turn out to be nasty in the euro area as a result of this, and things begin to fray, one would expect that Europe would move up the issues, not just for the reasons that Mads has said, in the coming general election. So that's why I think it matters. I agree about the dangers of presidentism, but we live in very challenging times.
Thank you. Because of the admirable discipline of our speakers, we've got 50 minutes now for questions and discussion. Can I just start by saying two things? Can you keep your questions short? If you want to, do feel free to address them to any of the speakers you've heard, and please introduce yourself before you speak. And for the panellists, you don't all need to respond to every question if we're going to try and keep this moving. So we'll try and turn this into a debate. And there are roving mics, which I can't see. But okay. So, yeah, gentlemen, that.
Yeah, I mean, my question very briefly is the implication for Britain's interests and the looking after British interests of the more than doubling or the likely doubling of UKIP's representation. You've all seen, I have no doubt, the devastating analysis on page 3 of the Financial Times today about their voting record, not least in the Economics Committee, where important votes on financial transactions tax were lost because the UKIP members didn't show up. So, I mean, is it likely that the greater fragmentation as a result of the election is basically going to see our interests, the interests of the City of London to start with, not looked after by our MEPs?
Did you want to...
Good evening. Thank you for your interventions. I have quite a specific question, and I would like all the panellists to answer. In your personal capacities, and I would like your opinions, what chances do you think a new pro-European party would have at standing in these European elections, specifically a party which would target young people, disenfranchised students who don't want to vote for Lib Dems, people who don't want to vote for the Tories because of many reasons, I guess, but who don't want to then also vote for UKIP and give them their protest vote. Do you think, this is a multifold question, but do you think this kind of party would just simply dilute the pro-Europeans and take away votes from the Lib Dems, or whether it has a chance of standing against UKIP, and whether, there's any point in starting such a project? Background to this question, I'm involved in starting such a project. I'm Polish. I did my BA at the University of Bath. Then I went to the College of Europe and have worked for a British MEP in Brussels. So I know the issues and I know what's at stake, and I would like your personal opinions on this topic, please.
Okay, that's a lot to be going with. Should we start with those two and then...
Can I deal with the second question the lady asked? I mean, I think the party you want is really the Liberal Democrat Party, for this reason, that they're, for the first time since 1979, they're taking a gamble and fighting on a very strong pro-European ticket. It's interesting, in 1979, circumstances were different, but their vote in the European elections was fairly close to that in the national elections, and they didn't lose much of their vote. Of course, it was a short distance of time from the national elections. And what they're hoping this time is to mobilise perhaps a minority, but their middle-class, if you like, intellectual support, the support of EU citizens living in Britain, and perhaps, as you suggest, younger voters, though, of course, we know they tend to vote much less than older people, but they're hoping to mobilise that into being the only pro-European party. And I think that will give an indication of how strong pro-Europeanism is in Britain. So I think if you formed another party, you would split the pro-European vote.
Just on that particular question, I mean, I agree with what Vernon said about the Lib Dems. The party political broadcast last week by the Lib Dems was astonishing in it being a vote for us, we're the only pro-European party. They didn't talk about domestic politics at all, and this is the first European election broadcast I've ever seen that was of that ilk. And I think it's because they have nothing to lose. But I think what's critical here, and it's interesting that you're Polish, is with the salience of these elections and the salience of immigration and the volume of new EU migrants to the UK over the last decade, and if there is a low turnout, it's going to be interesting to see whether these EU, non-British EU citizens voting in these elections might be pivotal in some constituencies, particularly in London and the South East. So it's a speculation, but it's going to be interesting to see how many turn out. I would guess a lot more will turn out than in any previous European election, and that could make the difference, particularly for the Lib Dems, for example, holding on to a seat in London. On the other question about Britain's representation in the European Parliament, I mean, MEPs, yes, they do represent national interests. Most of all, though, they represent particular political positions. It's who will represent the type of views that, as you said, the City of London, those types of views are interested in. I think what I expect to happen in the European Parliament elections, not just in Britain but everywhere, is a big polarisation, and this alludes to what Mad said. I think there'll be the two biggest groups in the Parliament on the centre-left and the centre-right will be significantly reduced compared to where they are now. Lib Dems, Liberals will probably be down. There'll be votes for the radical left with the rise of parties like Syriza in Greece. There'll be big growth in parties on the right. There could be three groups to the right of the EPP, the group the British Conservatives sit in, a new radical right group with Wilders and Le Pen and colleagues, a new version of the Eurosceptic group with a larger UKIP plus potential other allies. Nigel Farage has mentioned the five-star movement in Italy. I don't know what their view is of sitting with Farage. A much more fragmented parliament means it's much more difficult to do business, much more difficult to get things done, and it will force a grand coalition between the two biggest groups. And traditionally, that grand coalition between those two biggest groups has been a Franco-German coalition, has not been particularly welcoming to British interests, particularly the views of the German Social Democrats right now. And Schulz, the epitome of the German Social Democrat view right now, and we're seeing this in the new coalition in Germany. The German Social Democrat view is that the financial crisis is largely the Anglo-Saxons' fault, and it's the British bankers who should be punished for that. So that could well be what the mainstream view of the European Parliament, the next European Parliament, could be, opposed by a very polarised view. I agree with Matt that for most European voters, they're not in favour either of a kind of centrist Euro-federalism or this radical extreme tear the whole damn thing up and start again. I think the average European voter is probably of the view that there are things wrong with the EU, we'd like it to be more accountable, we'd like it to be more efficient, we'd like it to listen to us as citizens. We don't want to get rid of it. There's a lot of things we like about the EU, with the consumption patterns we have in the single market, our ease of travel and all the rest of it. And there's nothing right now. I don't see a political movement in Europe right now that represents that kind of moderately critical view, but pro-European view of Europe. I don't see that as a mainstream political position in Europe right now. You're either radically anti-European or hugely Euro-federalist.
I'm not sure. Can you hear me okay? Firstly, in relation to the question about UKIP, increased UKIP representation in the European Parliament, well, if that does happen, they'll have less excuse for not participating in the committees and the votes than is currently the situation. Their current position is it doesn't make a difference. It is likely to make more of a difference after the next elections, I think. In relation to the Ladies' new party, well, firstly, let me wish you good luck. I think anyone that sets up a political party deserves a lot of admiration. Secondly, however, I think you have to think about what your political party is going to stand for. If it's pro-EU in the UK, then presumably it's not just continued membership. It has to be us joining the euro, us getting rid of our opt-ins and being a full member of Area of Freedom, Security and Justice. And maybe that is a position that, you know, we should have people articulating that. Okay. I mean,
what does that mean?
Okay. It's for you to decide what you want to stand for. I mean, the only thing I'd say is I think I have a slight disagreement with Simon. Parties are more successful if they don't just put constitutional reform, important though us lawyers think it is, and you have a lot of policies as well, whatever they may be.
On this, on UKIP, the UKIP attendance record, which I suppose is what we, the question was primarily about. Well, I mean, I'm disappointed. I think you can be very sort of, you know, being against EU membership is a fully legitimate position. I mean, there's nothing wrong being that. We, you know, most people in this room would disagree, but that's not doesn't necessarily translate into not showing up and do the committee work. So I think it is a bit of a problem there, and I really do hope that the next batch of UKIP MEPs will actually show up and vote on, for example, the UCITS bonus cap, which would have been a disaster for the UCITS funds. I mean, it's not that difficult. Show up, vote no, and leave. You know, so I agree with you, basically. Now, on the wider point, but it's not, this one doesn't follow the other. Just because you're anti-EU doesn't mean that you have to have a poor attendance record. On the wider point, though, I totally agree, and this is really worrying. The risk is that we're looking at a very business-unfriendly European Parliament, precisely because it gets so polarised. It's not only about financial services. Take TTIP, for example, the US-EU trade agreement. The European Parliament will have a veto over that deal. It will have a veto. I don't know this part of particularly well, but is Front National interested in TTIP? Probably not. Similar parties aren't particularly interesting in TTIP. But at the same time, will Guy Verhofstadt, you know, the Belgian Liberal MEP, will he get sort of one of his ideas and hijack it for some completely random reason, like civil liberties, fully legitimate, obviously, but when Guy Verhofstadt argues it, it usually has something to do with him trying to push a personal agenda, with respect. And he sort of bring that group with him, and all of a sudden you have a situation where the nationalist populists don't show up to vote for TTIP, and the federalists hijack it over completely unrelated issues. That would be bad. So again, polarized parliament, European Parliament, we have to be aware of that. On this pro-European party, I don't know how much constituency it is for it here in the UK, but I can give you one piece of advice. Please make sure that Vivian Reding never gives a speech in the UK ever again. Her papers were not stolen, though, including this, including the source for the claim, which backed up Nigel Farage beautifully. That's 70% of all British laws are now made in Brussels. I mean, Nigel Farage was just like, he was sitting back having a pint and was just enjoying that.
Thank you. Gentlemen.
Yes, I'm a psychologist, and there's a moral issue here. When I say I wouldn't do that, it's because I have pride in who I am. I am me, not someone neighbour to me. And that identity gets weaker and weaker the further it gets from me. So that saying I'm a human being is very, very weak. I'm a European. That's also weak. To say I'm English is getting a bit stronger. To say I'm from London is getting stronger. Family. So the further you can get away from generalization, the more morality survives. So that is the moral issue. The only thing is, as far as nations are concerned, you have to prohibit theft. Once a nation tries to steal from another, you have to prohibit
it. Have you got a question? Do you have a question for the panel? Okay.
Identity.
Identity.
Yeah, then give it to John.
Thank you. I just wanted to reply to what Matt's just said. I'm Jacqueline Miner. I represent the European Commission in London. And first of all, you know, I think it's not helpful, particularly to personalise this debate by referring to one member of the Commission. And to be fair to the lady who is my boss, I have to say, she always says, when I talk about the Commission being the government of Europe, this is my view. It may not be your view, but we should have a debate about it. She always prefaces that statement with those words. And as to the 70% much debated and discussed figure, I think she's since gone on the record to say that in the heat of the citizens' dialogue, she misspoke. And what she meant to say was that 70% of European legislation is now determined by the European Parliament. So I think she has been misquoted on that.
Yeah, apart from the fact that she said it on two separate occasions, including in Sweden, where she actually topped it. She topped it up. She said 80%.
Yeah, but
and I can give you that exact quote. So, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I don't think... I think I'm pretty sound, solid ground here when I say that she is Nadia Farage's best friend. Sorry. Sorry, I can't help it. It's nothing personal, it's just a fact.
Can I just ask a question
as well?
I'll use the privilege of holding the microphone. Various panellists, when they first spoke, alluded to what is likely to happen after the European elections with the leading candidates. But I think it would be interesting to go into their views in a little more detail. Exactly what will happen at that first European Council and at the first confrontation between the European Council and the Parliament when it comes to the nomination and confirmation of the candidate for President of the European Commission, in their view?
John, you've got a quick...
Well, actually, yes, I would like to follow that slightly. I start from a position of not being a great fan of the European Parliament, as I think Simon and others probably know. But one thing that many governments, not just the British government, but many governments across Europe have been increasingly saying is that national parliaments need to play a bigger role. And it's something you hear also in Germany and also in countries from Eastern Europe. And I'd like to hear from the panel about, particularly in the light of what Jackie has just said, we may have a president of the Commission who in effect is chosen by the bigger parliamentary groups. It could be Juncker, Verhofstadt or Schulz, who to me are all indistinguishable in their views. How can we get national parliaments to get a bigger role if that's where we're going?
Who wants to come back on any of those two questions?
I'm happy to start. In relation to Jacqueline Miner's question about what happens when the fight starts, it's speculation, so I'm only speculating and I may well be wrong. I do think the European Parliament has less aces than it thinks it has. Now there is not a monopoly on agenda setting in the same way for the Commission as previously. We have the European Council presidents. Of course, they don't have formal agenda setting powers. But the European Parliament's had vetoes before, which is threatened but not exercised. I mean, there will be a fight, and I'm not saying it won't exercise influence. I would say that, of course, the European Parliament lost a lot of friends with member states over its exercise of the veto over the Czech opt-out from the Charter. And this caused a lot of resentment. The idea was it had been promised to the Czechs, it was not granted to them when Croatia acceded. And it would be interesting to see what happened. That's all I say. I think we'll wait and see. On national parliaments, I'm a big advocate of national parliaments being more involved, and there are, of course, lots of proposals for this at the moment in all kinds of ways. My own view is that one of the reasons there is less legislation coming out of Brussels at the moment, a big reason for it is the Barroso dialogue. We've already had two yellow cards, one heeded by the Commission, one at the moment not fully. I would like them to be much more involved. They could be much more involved if they wanted to be. You could have a situation which is a sort of super mandate where councils don't give their approval and ministers don't give their approval in the council unless the parliamentary committee has actually given approval rather than just given them the mandate. There are all kinds of things that could be done within the current framework.
I will respectfully disagree with Damien. Already there's positioning about what's going to happen after the elections, and it's interesting that Van Rompuy had arranged a summit meeting very soon after the elections, and then there was uproar in the Parliament to say, how dare you have a summit meeting when we wouldn't have had a chance to meet yet. And interestingly, Van Rompuy backed down within 24 hours. And I think the Parliament is spoiling for a fight. And I'd actually see it as Parliament versus Council. These are political groups, political actors. It's very easy for the UK to kind of paint it as Parliament versus Council. If you're in Brussels, it's not seen like that. These are leaders of socialist parties who have chosen their candidate, and there was an argument within the Socialist Party about who it should be, and they've backed Schulz. There's an ongoing argument within the EPP about who their candidate is. Merkel is going to be absolutely crucial for deciding who this is, but once they've decided on that, previous examples from the EPP show that they mobilise pretty effectively around their view. I think there will be a grand coalition bargain between the EPP and the Socialists, and it will be brokered in Berlin. There's a grand coalition in Berlin. Germany's the most powerful member state. Merkel's the most powerful politician. The bargain will be whoever is the biggest group in the parliament gets the Commission president. The other big political group gets the president of the European Council. That'll be my bet right now, because that'll be a way for them to kind of finagle the largest group in the parliament connected to the elections. You get what you want, but we get what we want over here. That'll be a deal. Those two groups will vote in favour. Those two groups will have 50% of the votes. They'll be able to get that through. Looking at the polls right now, it's really close. The two groups are neck and neck. It could go either way. And so that would be my bet about what's going to happen. On the comment over here about identity, yes, of course, identity is crucially important. And that alludes to Mad's point that Britain, we do have a slightly different identity about this. But identities also change and are quite malleable. Just think about how quickly Scottish identity has developed over the last 20 or even 10 years and how it could develop rapidly even faster if Scotland votes later this year to leave the UK. Identities change pretty quickly, and they change not just for individuals, but they change generationally. And I think I wouldn't, and this is the focusing on the present and saying that Brits right now are hugely anti-European. Well, I don't know for sure whether that's going to be the case in 10 or 15 years' time. I wouldn't want to bet on that.
I think the question of identity is very important, and something you can't really argue with. It's primordial. You either do feel something or you don't. But I think that's not the only question facing Britain, because some people argue as if Britain has determining interest, a determining role in Europe, that if we decided something wasn't going to happen, it isn't going to happen. But it may be the case that whether we like it or not, the key members of the Eurozone are moving together towards a closer union. And then we have to face a very cruel and difficult question of what our attitude should be towards this development, which we certainly can't prevent if that's what other countries want to do. Now, George Osborne has said he encourages that. He said it will create stability. But on the other hand, it may create a powerful economic and political bloc which can act against our interests if we're not there. And this seems to be the key question. It mirrors the question facing British politicians in the late 50s when they decided whether to enter, because the attitude towards the coal and steel community, European army, and European common market on the part of Anthony Eden was that Britain doesn't want to be in it, but if the other countries want to go ahead, good luck to them. But Harold Macmillan took the view, if that happened, there'll be a powerful bloc which will be outside. We must be there where the decisions are made. And that is parallel to the debate about Scotland, because Scotland is facing the problem that if she becomes independent, she will no longer be represented in the House of Commons and will have to negotiate under possibly difficult conditions for what she now has as of right. And this is going to be our position, and the Swiss referendum on immigration shows that you may have to negotiate through all sorts of bilateral treaties for things which now you have as of right and can actually influence because you're there. It's a very cruel and difficult dilemma, not to be resolved simply by saying, well, are we or are we not European? It's a cruel dilemma, as I say, which British governments have to face. They wouldn't have chosen. If British government had a blank sheet of paper, they'd probably rather the European Union didn't exist at all. But it does exist, and the Eurozone exists. What should be our attitude towards it?
Is this on? Is this on? Yeah. We'll see how much the Eurozone can do in common. I agree with the risk, but the extent of that risk is still unknown, precisely because of identity politics. And the interesting part about Germany, actually, Germany is an extremely interesting test case, because in Germany, the clash is not so much between anti- and pro-Europeans, it's between commitment to Europe and commitment to sound money. Both of them are deeply embedded in German identity. Post-World War II, German identity. And to see how that plays out is absolutely fascinating. Now, on these points about national parliaments, and I confess, I think the European Parliament isn't always coming up with the optimal policies. So what should we do about it? Well, I think the Dutch have been very interesting on this. So I think actually the Dutch government, not the UK government, the Dutch government has emerged as the thought leader. And they've been looking at different cards. So you have the red card, which is effective veto, which is also in the CDU manifesto now, where a number of parliaments come together and they can effectively veto a commission proposal. Not one parliament, but a group of parliaments. That's one solution, one idea. Another one is this idea of a green card, where national parliaments have the right to initiate legislation, even also including overturning existing EU law, which is a very interesting proposal, because that gets away from this, what I would say is considered a flaw in the EU decision-making process, that once a law is agreed, it's incredibly hard to change. Much, much harder than a national system, because you need a call for majority votes, and most often also a majority in the European Parliament. Therefore, a law can remain in place for a very long time, even if everyone, almost everyone, agrees that it's not fit for purpose. And then a third idea is this idea of a late card, just sort of continuing the card analogy, where you have a sort of a last line of defence, where at the end of co-decision, national parliaments have a chance to, in some way or another, raise concerns. And I think in combination, that will not lead to deadlock, because it actually is quite difficult for national parliaments to agree, but it will definitely serve to focus minds in the European Commission and in the European Parliament and lead to less and better EU intervening.
Can we directly on that?
Can I just ask very quickly, why should it not be much easier for national parliaments to hold their representatives, their governments, the EU Parliament accountable and get them to act in this way rather than mobilise all the national parliaments to then coordinate
and make it. Do you mean pre-existing mandates as in Denmark? Is that what you're...
Finland, yeah.
Well, I think... I didn't know it was in Finland as well, but I think, if I may say so, it only works for one or two perhaps fairly small countries. I think it couldn't operate the European Union if 28 countries relied on ministers being mandated to make a common policy.
But even scrutiny after negotiations are not very effective. We don't have committees in national...
That's a different point.
I think that one doesn't necessarily exclude the other. I think, if anything, one of the reasons why national parliaments have been so slow to get their act together, including, by the way, the UK Parliament, this hotbed of Euroscepticism, has objected twice last year on subsidiarity grounds, I think House of Commons did. Twice, only two times. If the EU does so much wrong, why is it only in two cases that it has violated the subsidiary principle? So that's an interesting question in its own right. But I think one of the reasons is precisely because they have very little power to influence EU decisions. If it gets that power, I think you have an incentive to actually get more involved. But I actually disagree with this point that it will not work in other countries. I think it would. And I think it would work with this mandate-based system. I think it would work really, really well in the UK, for example, precisely because the UK is a first-past-the-post system. One of the problems with the Danish or the Swedish model, which works slightly better, usually the case, is that it's a proportional representation, meaning that almost always you have a government. Here you actually have a single sort of a first-past-the-post system, meaning that you have the chance for backbenchers to actually hold the government to account.
It works in Denmark, as I understood it, though I'm open to correction, because of the prevalence of minority governments in Denmark, that ministers couldn't be certain that they could carry the Folketing with them. Sorry? Because of the committee work. But it's very difficult to imagine that 28 countries could negotiate under firm mandates from their national parliaments beforehand.
Yeah, but it's not... we're going on about the same thing, but we've all given evidence to the same committee in the House of Commons on exactly this point, so that's why we have different views on it. But I think there's a misconception about what this mandate from national parliaments really is in practice. In practice, what it is a minister goes to a committee before a council meeting and explains what the government's position is on this issue before the committee. And then after the council meeting, they go back to the committee and they explain what happened in the council and what their view was of what happened in the council. We don't do that in the UK. It's appalling we don't do that in the UK, and there's no reason why we shouldn't do that.
Can I just come in on this? Can I just say two things? Can I say two things? First of all, as a point of information, it's actually about a third of member states now use the mandate system, some more intensively than others. For those who are interested, it's in a 2011 COSAC report. In relation to the mandate, it fails to do two things that I think are quite important. One Mads has alluded to, which is the green card. At the moment, I think it's wrong that any bureaucracy has a monopoly of initiative. They don't in national legislatures, really. One allows backbench MPs, it seems to me, to one allows a citizens' initiative. It doesn't seem too unreasonable to allow national parliaments to put forward their own ideas rather than just sort of vet commission ideas. The second issue, and this I feel actually even more strongly about, is my understanding of collective action is that parliaments actually have to say yes before we do something. That you don't do anything unless a parliament says yes. That is not the way the mandate works, or for that matter, the council. It's more that it goes forward unless you can be bothered to get out of bed. And this is the issue a little bit with the subsidiarity problem. They should be actively saying yes. This is what exists anywhere else. And this idea that if they fail to turn up, consent is presumed, I think is very weak for our democracy, whatever one's view on identity.
As a rule of thumb, when people start citing COSAC reports, it's time to move on. So,
not the same. Thank you. I should preface what I'm going to say by saying that I'm a civil servant, but I'm here in my personal capacity. Looking back at the question that leads this debate, the panel, I've noticed, have often used the words the European Union and Europe synonymously. But, of course, in the great public discourse around this issue, there's, of course, a significant controversy around a completely separate European organisation. That's the Council of Europe, and specifically its European Court of Human Rights. And that's been substantially conflated in a lot of the media reporting and, indeed, even some of the election positions that are being taken. To what extent do the panel think that this is going to influence the voting in this country? But perhaps more significantly, to what extent do the panel think there's going to be a reaction following the elections when it turns out the voting for the European Parliament doesn't actually have anything to do with the European Court of Human Rights at all?
Gentlemen, the front row here. Okay.
Thank you. I have a question for Damien. You mentioned the German Constitutional Court's ruling on the OMT, and I was wondering why the Bundesverfassungsgericht as a national court is given this extraordinary power to basically rule over the ECB and tell them to go back to the drawing board, and why we don't see any other national courts stepping up and saying, yeah, we want to rule over that too. And what is actually the legal basis for that? Thank you.
Do you want to answer that one straight?
Okay, one of the two dissenting judges agreed with you. They said this is precisely what is implicit in your question, which is they said the German Bundesverfassungsgericht shouldn't be deciding for the whole of Europe. This is one of the dissents. The second point to be made is they're not alone. The Czech Constitutional Court has also overturned a Court of Justice judgment in 2012. The legal basis is that they say the EU is an organisation, like anyone else, a public law organisation. So in this case, what they argued was it shouldn't act ultra vires. That is the basis under which, according to the German Constitutional Court, Germany entered this process of European integration, and that is the basis on which European integration should proceed lawfully, according to them. Their view at the moment is that that is what has taken place, and therefore the basis for Germany's participation, that's all they're talking about in their judgment, is undermined, or they think it might be.
Okay, should we answer the first question as well?
You want me to? I can have a go. I mean, I agree that the European Convention on Human Rights and the Court of Human Rights that polices it, and some decisions recently against the UK have had high salience, but I really don't think it's going to play much of a role in these elections. The elections are going to be primarily about UKIP, how well is UKIP going to do? If UKIP does incredibly well, does that really damage the Conservative Party? I mean, I just looked up some data on the latest opinion poll standings, and Labour standing on 32. This is for a European election. The most recent European election opinion poll from YouGov. Labour 32, UKIP 26, Conservatives 23, Lib Dems 9, Greens 5. Well, what's significant about that is not just the Conservatives coming third or Labour coming first, but the combined vote share of UKIP and the Conservatives, the two pro-referendum parties, is almost 50%. So there'll be plenty of people coming away from that saying 50% of the public in this election have voted for parties that have promised us a referendum on Britain's relationship with Europe. We want it now. And there'll be a lot of pressure, particularly from Conservative backbenchers, seeing those numbers. That is what the election, I think, is primarily going to be about. I don't think it's going to touch on these sorts of issues.
And pressure on the Labour and Liberal Democrats to come out for a referendum as well. I think that's equally important.
I mean, actually, on the ECHR, it's not entirely rational to confuse EU and ECHR, because if you look at the European Court of Justice and ECHR, it's not always entirely clear which case law influences which. It's a very interesting dynamic, actually, and of course the EU will accede to the ECHR itself, where you'll have a link. But certainly, in terms of Cameron, as a general remark, if he hypothetically can pull out of the ECTHR, the court, then he will free up a lot of space on the renegotiation agenda, if you know what I mean. So that will count, that will be a box ticked. It will count towards his wider renegotiation plan in the public mind. On the Bundesverfassungsgericht, favourite topic, obviously. You know, I actually find it all... First of all, I agree, it's not only the German Constitutional Court. The Portuguese Constitutional Court struck down austerity measures, for example. The Spanish Constitution, deeply problematic, because it's a very regional structure. So it comes up against some of these austerity measures. So it's constitutional system versus constitutional system. That's really the story of the Eurozone crisis. But if you think about it, if you take a step back, Germany underwrites 28%, I think, roughly 28% of any bailout package, also via the capital contribution to the European Central Bank. The ECB is ultimately taxpayer-backed. Ultimately taxpayer-backed, 28% for that. It's even more in the bailout packages, because, of course, Germany is in that part of that kind of esteemed sort of diminishing group of beasts that actually have a AAA rating. So therefore, it has a much larger share. It's not surprising that the Germans are a little bit uncomfortable about the plausibility of this rescue package. The second point about this, and this what always confuses me and surprises me with Anglo-Saxon commentators and Americans in particular, but also the British. You guys set up Germany as a deliberately slow-moving system after World War II. That's what you guys did, John. I mean, that's what happened. It was you got rid of the Weimar Republic's executive emergency powers. You put the Bundesverfassungsgericht in as a circuit break to prevent rash decision-making power. You cannot come back and say, why, what are you guys doing? Why are you doing exactly what we wanted you to do? It's odd. Seriously, the Bundesverfassungsgericht is what the Bundesverfassungsgericht is, a constitutional court. We have to deal with it.
Just returning to the issue of the UK and the European Parliament election, I was wondering, I'd like the panel's view, not just on the influence of the election outcomes on the likelihood of getting a referendum, but also whether you have a view of whether there will be any influence of the election outcomes of whether or not Britain will stay in or whether they will leave the EU, if you think there will be any.
The gentleman behind you is having.
Thank you very much. I'd just like to ask the panel, all the panel in their personal experiences, what proportion of integrationists have they met who are on the payroll of the European institutions and what proportion who are not?
I'm an integrationist and I'm not.
Allegedly. That's on camera.
My question goes to the whole panel as well. What are your views on the public view on the processes of the European Parliament in general. My experience is that, coming from Germany, the public attention on what happens in the national parliament is way more bigger than what happens in the European Parliament. How would you assess the comparison in terms of attention to the national parliament and the European Parliament? And do you think, after this election, whether there will be any change in the rate of attention?
Mats, do you want to go? If we're quick, we can get another round of questions.
On the payroll question, I have no scientific statistic on that, so I think I'll pass. I'm certainly not in the payroll of European institutions, and I don't think I will be in a while. What was the question about the referendum? Whether the European elections will make it more or less likely that Britain leaves the EU? Whether the European election results? It's hard to tell. I mean, if UKIP scores a major victory, then I suppose that will reverberate. But to be honest, I think there's enough headline between the European elections and the general elections for that to kind of fade slightly. So I think this will come down to the general elections rather than European elections. And it will come down to that potential vote in 2017. That's when it will be decided. And what Cameron, if he gets re-elected, what he can bring back. EP and national parliaments, well, I think others are probably better. Like, Simon, you've been spending a long time, part of your life, looking at this. But I think in general, you know, the European Parliament deals not only but primarily with regulation. Whereas national parliaments deal a lot more with kind of the wallet issues, that's taxation and spending. And I think that just, it's a natural consequence of that. Voters will pay much more attention to national parliaments. But again, the best thing the European Parliament itself can do in order to sort of generate more voters' interest in its activities is to behave more like a normal parliament. You know, if you build it, they will come.
Yeah. Can I answer Sarah Hobolt's question, which is a difficult one, which is no doubt why she asked it. But the question was how the European elections will affect the chances of Britain staying in or leaving the EU. Difficult question to answer, but as I said, David Cameron has legitimised the option of leaving Europe as a subject for political debate. Now, the better that UKIP does, obviously, the more that option will become legitimised. And UKIP has already become legitimised. For example, when you have discussions about the budget on the BBC, UKIP is now one of the parties represented. Nigel Farage has appeared on Question Time on many occasions. So it's becoming a legitimate option, which, what one might call very loose term, the establishment is beginning to discuss. And I think that's all one can say, that it may increase the legitimacy of that option. On the question about the payroll and the European Parliament, can I just say this? I mean, the hope of people who increased the powers of the European Parliament was that as it became, in effect, a co-legislator, it would win popular support. But you don't get democratic legitimacy just because of the powers you've got, but because voters identify with an institution as speaking for them. And the difficulty is that Europe, the European Union, is perceived as an elite project, and the European Parliament not as the representative of the people controlling that elite project, but as the representatives of them towards us rather than us towards them. So it's seen as part of a kind of alienated superstructure, and people feel alienated, all opinion polls in most countries, from domestic decision makers. They say they're too remote, they don't take any notes of what we're saying, and so on and so on. So of course they feel even more remote from something at that distance. Now, I don't know how you alter that, but it's a problem that was ignored at Maastricht, and it's been ignored since. And this is a fundamental problem you have to deal with if you're in favour of European integration. How do you manage to secure identification of the public with the European project, which began very consciously by Jean Monnet as an elite project, that it would move by small continuous steps that people wouldn't notice until you woke up one morning and found we were integrated. That's no longer possible, I think, in the modern world. And of course, the Eurozone is a discontinuous part of the project that people do notice.
I would add a couple of things to that. It's not irrational to be pro-European without being on the EU payroll. there are some people who are pro-European because they're on the payroll. There's plenty of people who are anti-European because they're on some other payroll that makes them anti-European. But, I mean, I think it's not necessarily connected. In terms of the... I agree with a lot of what Vernon said. I like the fact there are Eurosceptics in the European Parliament. It's healthy for Europe, it's healthy for the European Parliament that Nigel Farage is elected and that UKIP get elected, and it's healthy that Wilders and Le Pen... This is what democracy is all about. These people should be there. They should represent the views of the European people, and if those are the views of the European people and they are elected people, I hope they show up. And I hope that they articulate those views so those views can be televised and so there can be a proper debate about Europe and so gradually voters could start to see the European Parliament as representative of them and their views, not of the views of the people in Brussels. So in that I agree with. I'd say a bit more. If UKIP come first in these elections, it's going to be very, very difficult for the other party leaders to deny Nigel Farage a place at the table in live TV debates the next European election. Say, I won a national election. You guys lost. I have to be at the table. And so if we're going to have debate, and so I think that could be a huge impact for then the role of Europe as part of the national election debate. Even if UKIP start to go down in the polls, I think it's going to be very difficult for that. The other thing we haven't mentioned is... if UKIP does hugely well in England and Wales, what is the impact of that on the Scottish referendum? Alex Salmond is hoping that UKIP does really, really well so he can say, look, England is heading towards the exit door. If you want to stay in the EU, vote for Scottish independence.
I think one needs to distinguish carefully between Farage on the one hand and Wilders and Le Pen on the other. I think Farage's position is a perfectly legitimate position. I agree with Simon, it ought to be properly represented. But I think Wilders and Le Pen incite hatred against particular religious or racial groups. And I think that is not a position that ought to be represented. Indeed, I think it ought to be banned by law, as I think it probably would be in this country. But I mean, I think Farage is not in that position. And he said he wouldn't sit with them in the European Parliament, in a group with them in the European Parliament. I think it's important to make that distinction.
No. We've got time, if we're quick, for a couple more questions, if there are any.
Up there.
Yeah.
You can just say it from up there.
Yeah, don't fall over.
Yeah, it's great. We had the Swiss referendum on Sunday, and I personally hope that the EU plays a very hard role with the Swiss. Do you think we have sufficient time for the repercussions of that to have an effect on the elected, either the UK or the rest of Europe?
Who'd like to answer that one?
It's going to be interesting because you've seen people. I mean, if you read the Daily Telegraph, Dan Hanan's already had a go about the wonderful Swiss and how we should be nice to them after their vote. It is likely to lead to a deterioration of relations between EU and Switzerland because the European Commission, at least, and I think it wasn't alone in this, had already said that it was unhappy with the bilateral approach as it was, and they had to rethink, and they wanted Switzerland in some sort of EEA-style package. So it's a very whether it'll affect people's votes, I'm sceptical about. But it does give the opportunity for, should I say, opportunistic arbitrage by some people. Like you saw the British government already saying, well, they're just reflecting what people think. And they clearly saw it as something that could be used.
Yeah, well, it's an excellent question, actually. I wrote something on this on my Telegraph blog, and I got almost 2,000 comments. All of them were angry. So this is something that definitely stirs up emotion in Britain. And some of them were commenting on my Swedish heritage, you know, which was completely arbitrary in this situation. They are Switzerland, we are Sweden. That's not the same thing. One is landlocked. Now, I think it's going to be extremely... there are two countries for which this is extremely interesting, I think. Germany and the UK. Germany because of links, and they're a very tricky position, but primarily for Britain, because the precedent will be key, as you said. But what precedent will this set? Well, they can play hardball. The EU can play hardball, obviously, as you suggest, saying that this is not acceptable. You cannot pick and choose what parts of the single market you are part of, which is a silly thing to do, actually, because the problem with the Swiss deal is precisely that it's pick and choose. That's why it's not suitable for UK, because it will not grant automatic access in services, including financial services. So that would be slightly wrong. Or it can sort of say, actually, we're going to grant you a carve-out on immigration here. No matter small, we're going to grant you something. For Cameron, either way is a loose situation. Because from Cameron's point of view, if the EU grants Switzerland a carve-out, then the better-off outers in this country will jump on that immediately and say, look what Switzerland got. They got a precedent, they got exactly what we want, which is more or less accessing the market, but not free movement, which is the most high-profile issue in the UK. So, but on the other hand, if the EU plays hardball and Cameron backs that, then better off outers will see, so you're denying the Swiss the very same thing that you want to give the British? Was it consistent in that? So he cannot say anything that will appease people here. So he needs to stay quiet. But I have a feeling that when he meets Merkel, Angela Merkel, on February 27th, he will privately lobby. And I don't know this, so I don't know this. So this is just speculation. But he will privately lobby for Merkel to take a very tough line, precisely because he doesn't want to give UKIP ideas.
And I wouldn't normally quote reports in the House of Commons, but there's an interesting report by the Foreign Affairs Select Committee in the House of Commons on options for Britain. And what the members of the committee did was actually go to the Swiss Parliament and the Norwegian Parliament and talk to those parliamentarians in their Foreign Affairs Committee. And for me, this was the most interesting section of this report, because it converted a lot of these Eurosceptic Conservative MPs when they met these Norwegian and Swiss MPs, who said, do not become us. You're much better inside, having influence at the table, and you're a big, powerful member state. We have no power on the outside, and we have to take what we're given, and you will be in the same position if you leave.
Immigration is one of the three top issues of concern to British voters. 43% are concerned about it. The Oxford sophologist Geoffrey Evans wrote a paper published recently saying that there was a case for arguing that immigration rather than the economy had been responsible for Gordon Brown's election defeat in 2010. Now, until 1962, this country had free immigration from the Commonwealth for 800 million people. In 1962, that was restricted, and the Labour opposition opposed it, but in office tightened the restrictions because they said that was a precondition of good ethnic relations. We now have free entry from the European Union, that 500 million people have a right of entry into this country, but by contrast with the Commonwealth, we cannot alter it by our own legislation. And that's a very graphic illustration for many people in Britain of what the loss of parliamentary sovereignty actually means. It's a highly emotive issue, not for us, because on the whole, a support for immigration is greater amongst the better educated and the more articulate, but for many people in Labour's natural constituency, it's a key and fundamental issue and a very graphic illustration. And it's graphic in Britain because of our long tradition of parliamentary sovereignty, which isn't shared on the continent, so that other countries were able to say, we will sacrifice sovereignty without necessarily realising what it means until a concrete example later comes along. In Poland, for example, it was the case of abortion. In Germany, it's now the case of mutual sharing of debts. It's easy to say in general terms, we're happy to integrate and sacrifice sovereignty, until you come to a highly concrete issue. And the issue of immigration is a highly emotive and concrete issue for many people in Britain, not in this audience, but many people who don't go to political meetings, but who, of course, are voters. And therefore, I think the Swiss decision will have some considerable influence on British opinion in the Euro elections.
Okay. It remains for me now just to thank the speakers for, I think, kicking off the Contesting Europe series to a very, very good start. I would give a plug to the next event, but I don't know what it is or when it is, so...
I can't do that, I'm afraid. But thank you all for coming. I'm sure there'll be many debates on this issue in the weeks and months to come. And thank you all, four of you, for excellent interventions.
Immigration is a perfect issue.